Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guest, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Harlow Giles-Unger with us, the author of Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman. Acclaimed historian Harlow Giles-Unger is a former distinguished visiting fellow at George Washington's Mount Vernon. He's the author of 24 books, including 11 biographies of America's founding fathers and three histories of the early republic. And let us say, Harlow, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. History. What was it about history that caught you? What was it that made that light bulb go on and you said, this is mine?
Well, if we don't know our own history, we won't have a democracy very, very long. Ignorance is the death knell of democracy and liberty. It's up to every American to study and learn as much about the history of this nation as possible. That's one of the sad things that we've seen in recent years in Congress. They just don't seem to understand our history. The idea of John Boehner, who just resigned, of course, as Speaker of the House,
sure.
The idea of his threatening to shut down government because a group of 20 people in the House of Representatives want to do things their way. I mean, that's the way the Nazis acted and the communists. The way we do things in this country and have for centuries, and Henry Clay was the foremost progenitor of this approach, is compromise, because this is a huge nation. Our interests, the interests of 350 million people, differ from person to person. And because Congress won't do what I want it to do does not make it dysfunctional. It's called
right.
Democracy. Alexander.
I wonder if any of the kids today know what that word means because of what's happening in the high schools. And another thing too with Henry Clay, okay, dedicated his life to public service. But if you were to define public service today and public service in his day, it was a completely different definition. You know, there were challenges that go on today that he didn't have in those days. But
oh, yes,
what was
did.
It about him?
Yes, he did. The nation was splitting apart. The South had wanted to separate from the North for 50 years during his years in the House, and he held them together. He held the Union together until we were a mature enough nation that when we did have a civil war after he had died, we were able to survive because of the cohesion of the 20 states in the North, in the Central United States, in the Midwest, and even to the West. He had set up a system during his years. It was the greatest economic system in the history of the world. He called it the American system, in which he got the feuding leaders of the different states and the president. And incidentally, he worked with 10 presidents. Boehner couldn't work
wow.
with one. He worked with 10, some of them bitter political opponents, and put together what he called the American system, which linked 20 states, every corner of 20 states, with roads, and at that time advanced roads, canals, and eventually railroads, that turned all of these people from people who lived in a state. Suddenly they became Americans because they moved
yeah.
from state to state. They set up businesses with branches in different states. Farmers and merchants shipped to different states and bought from different states. So they were no longer these isolated people in individual states. They were Americans, and they were willing now, after 40 years, to fight to preserve this union. And when you ask about Henry Clay, and his public what his public service was about. He explained it simply. If any, and these are his words, if anyone desires to know the leading and paramount objective of my public life, the preservation of the Union will furnish him the key. And unfortunately,
well, and I think the key was union. Union is engagement. Union means there's a commonality of definition for the destination that we're looking for, and I think that in and of itself is what we're missing today. I would love to get those people like Henry Clay and those people who originally were here that started what we have today back, because I really believe when it comes down to it, we've lost focus. I think the people left or right, doesn't really matter what side somebody's on anymore, that the direction is not a reflection of the will of the people.
They don't care.
No.
That's the problem.
Why should they?
Why should they? Because presumably they're educated people, and they're not educated. These are ignorant men and women. This group of 20 in Congress that threatened to close the nation if they don't get their way. This is the way the Nazis worked and the communists. It's not the way Americans work. We are one nation, indivisible. And we must work for that. You know, in the 225 years of congressional history since the first Congress met, they have only passed 5%, only 5% of the laws that have been proposed. And that's not because they're dysfunctional. People who call Congress dysfunctional only call it that way because they don't get their way. If Congress passes the law that I want, then it's fine. If it doesn't pass the law I want, then it's dysfunctional. But that's not true. That's democracy. Alexander Hamilton said, if you want a government that works efficiently and acts and does everything on the dime, get a dictator. But otherwise, embrace the system we have.
Yeah, let me hold you up for a minute, because they're very important, because back in the day when he was around, obviously he owned slaves himself. He was totally against it. But if you look at the world today, the government are owning slaves. You start giving things to people, you depend on the government, and people are going to do what the government tells them to do. So in essence, we have a tremendous amount of slavery today.
And if you want a form of slavery, just look in the slums of this nation and the poor backwaters, and see the way little children are growing up, ignorant, illiterate, with the worst conceivable schools. That's a formula for slavery. There's no way they can climb out of it and reach the seats of power and have any influence in their communities or in their nation. And that is a form of slavery. Bad education, which this Congress is responsible for, bad transportation, it takes us back to the Middle Ages. If people can't travel, they can't get ideas from other people. If they can't go to school or go to decent schools, they can't learn. They become slaves of ignorance. This is a formula for a return to ignorance, and the United States will die as a civilization if we continue in this way. If we allow a group of 20 zealots in a Congress of 365, if we allow 20 people to dictate to the rest without any consideration of what others want in this country, that's a formula for dictatorship. That's how Hitler took over.
Sure. So basically, if you go back and take a look at what went on in Germany right before World War II, they were in economic chaos. I'll tell you what they lost. They lost their identity. They weren't Germans anymore. They had no idea who they were. And that's exactly what's happening today. You know, you walk down the street and ask 10 people what an American is, a couple of them are going to jump on the flag, and you're going to get different answers across the board. And there's only a few of us left that will give you a definition of what America is and should be and should stay being.
Exactly. One of the most stupid articles I've seen in the run-up to Boehner's resignation was in his state's largest newspaper, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which praised him for having perfected, and this is the Cleveland Plain Dealer writing, perfected the art of disagreement without being disagreeable. That's not what a good speaker does. A good speaker perfects the art of compromise, not of disagreeing. Yeah. He's not supposed to disagree. He's supposed to compromise and engineer a way for all Americans to work together, to unite, and improve and build this country. And Boehner didn't.
Harlow, what we are missing, what we are missing today is going to the table values neutral. You leave the gotchas at the door. You come to the table and you create. You don't. You don't try to win, and that's exactly what's going on. It's a win-win.
That's why. That's why I wrote the book on Henry Clay, because he invented. He was called the Great Compromiser, and he was able to bring to keep North and South united, albeit angry at each other, but they remained united for 50 years until after his death, and finally they went to war.
Yeah, and when you really come down to it, they had this thought of America, and the other thing that happened in his day, when somebody came to America, they came in and they became Americans. What they did was they molded themselves within the society, so everybody was proud of being what they are. People are coming to this country today and trying to bring what they had here to change it. You know, and we've got a couple of...
Because it's not as big an investment. Remember, when people, even in the late 19th century, they sailed, it was a six-week voyage. They had to leave everything behind. They had to sacrifice to begin the voyage. Now you can hop on a plane, come over, drive a taxi for 6 weeks, make some money, and go home. You don't have to make the investment that you had to make in those days. And when they came over, they had to learn English. There was no choice.
Sure.
So
when I was a kid 100 years ago, we went to
school. I bet your friends don't believe you were a kid.
Oh yeah, that's true. They had no idea what a kid was. But when you go back to it, we did the Pledge of Allegiance every day. We loved our country. There was just something within us that we were proud of. We were proud of the flag. There was nothing wrong with that. But that's 1,000 years ago.
You're that old.
Well, maybe not that. Maybe 500 or 600 years. But there was a time, and there was a time when people were proud. There was a time when, if you said America across the world, they'd back off. There was consequence.
But there was a time when we had great statesmen. There was a time when we had a Washington or a Lincoln or a Henry Clay or a Roosevelt or an Eisenhower. People who united us during dark, dark times.
Yeah.
I remember listening to the radio, hearing Roosevelt's voice or Churchill's voice, and I thought bombs were going to drop on New York any minute, and I knew they wouldn't because Roosevelt wouldn't let it happen. it was a faith. And then Eisenhower later on, I mean, he just had to smile at you on television screen, and you knew all was right with the world, and just do your own job and go ahead and live your life, and everything will be fine.
You know, we have a problem when we elect somebody to the highest office in the world, and the first thing he does is run around the world and apologize for who we are.
Yep.
Then you know we got a problem.
And the worst thing, is that he has to govern using secret executive orders to do some of the things he promised to do, and do some of the things he promised not to do. So we have a president who's not straight forward with us and not doing what he was elected to do. But we also have the same thing in the House of Representatives. These are our representatives, and the speaker is the elect of the elect. He's elected by the entire nation, by the representatives of the entire nation, to do what the people want him to do. And he doesn't do anything. He wants to shut down the government, and in his spare time, he wants to use our tax money to sue the President of the United States. Now, anyone has the right to sue anybody in this country, but the Speaker of the House of Representatives does not sue the President of the United States of America. They are supposed to work together to further the interests of our country, of all the people. They are to serve the people, not to do whatever they please.
But the people, the people that are running this place right now, I have to say this place, two incidences. One, Barbara Boxer. she's talking about guns. Now, she has a gun. She has a concealed carry permit. But she said if you are approached with somebody with a gun and you have a gun, you put your gun down, and it's automatic. It's just human nature. They'll put their gun down, too. Where do we get this kind of a mindset? Nancy Pelosi.
Well, because, you can excuse Barbara Boxer. Barbara Boxer comes
not
from
for that.
Yes, she can be excused for anything because it's not up to you to excuse her. She comes from a neighborhood. She's elected by the people in that neighborhood, and they have certain unalienable rights just as you do. And they disagree with you, and they elected her. You don't have a chance to vote for her. Where you do have a chance is to vote for the speaker through your representatives. And the speaker should be reconciling extreme views, locking them out if necessary, but he should be reconciling all the views of 365 different congressmen to further the interests of the United States of America. You don't have the right to disagree. Well, you have the right to disagree with anybody, but you don't have a say in Barbara Boxer getting into Congress. That's the people of her neighborhood, and they have that right. Just as you have the right to elect the person in your neighborhood whom they may despise as much as you despise Barbara Boxer. That's their right. That's your right. Where you have to come together is when the speaker brings you together and say, now, this is in the best interest of our country. Now, if you will give a little bit here and you give a little bit there and we all come together, we will further. None of you will get all that you want. But none of you will lose everything. You're all going to sacrifice something. You're all going to be better off because the nation will be stronger. And that's what the speaker is supposed to do. That's what Henry Clay set out as the model that every great speaker in history has followed until this clown Boehner came to power. He's on his way out, and we have to pray that we get a speaker.
Oh, I'm glad he's gone. I'm with you. I'm glad he's gone. But by the way, then there was Nancy, okay? Oh, just sign it. You'll find out what's in it after it's voted in. See, my concern is, and I don't despise Barbara Boxer, I don't. My concern is this is the kind of mindsets that we have put into these positions of control, and they're in
control. But we didn't put Barbara Boxer into control. We put Nancy Pelosi into control. We put John Boehner into control. Barbara Boxer is simply an outspoken person. She comes from a district, and she has the right to represent those people. And these 20 clowns, these neo-Nazis who are holding the House hostage, this extreme right-wing Tea Party group, they have the right to their opinions, too. What they don't have the right to do is impose their opinions on me or you or anyone else outside their districts. They can only bring, they're only really allowed to bring their opinions into Congress. They can express themselves, and then they must bow to the speaker, ultimately to the speaker, who is charged with bringing all of those people in Congress together in the interests of the United States.
Okay, Harlow, let me hold you up for a minute because we could talk about this all night. I love having you on, but we got about 2 minutes to go. Let me ask this question. Getting back to the book, Henry Clay. I read the book page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael, the American, get from this book?
To recognize the importance of your representative and the importance of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and to participate in local politics so that you can influence the input of your representative. If you, you know, the turnout for off-year elections when there's no presidential candidate, the turnout for voting for Congress is very, very low. We're lucky if we get 20% of the eligible population voting for a representative. And your representative is an important voice in Congress. He or she has input into the election of and the actions of the Speaker of the House, who is the most important man in the federal government other than the president. The president is in charge of the executive branch. The Speaker of the House is in charge of the legislative branch. He or she decides what bills come to the floor, what bills can be voted up or down, and what bills can be ignored. So the speaker, Americans should recognize the importance of the speaker and begin to act as actively in the election of the speaker as they do in the election of the president of the United States.
And I hear you loud and clear. We're just about out of time, so let me ask you this. Website we can find you at and get the books.
You can get the book on, it's called Henry Clay, America's Greatest Statesman. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the bookstores online, and in your independent bookstores down the street, if they're still in business. My website is HarlowGilesUnger.com. As I say, the book is just come out. And is quite controversial because of the Boehner resignation and the fight we now have to try to get a great speaker. Clay was the greatest speaker, the greatest statesman in the history of the United States, and more Americans should know about him and what he did.
By the way, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
It's an honor to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Back on Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Dr. Jane Goldberg with us, PhD, the author of The Hormesis Effect, The Miraculous Healing Power of, listen to it closely, Radioactive Stones. She's been practicing psychoanalyst for about 35 years now. And as a psychoanalyst, she specialized in working with cancer patients and has successfully integrated her psychoanalytical work in the field of mind-body health. She's worked with many cancer patients who have defied the odds and attribute their success in combating the disease to the work that they've done with her. 1986, Dr. Goldberg founded the La Casa Resort Spa, located in Puerto Rico rainforest. She was persuaded by her resort guests to open a New York City facility so they could continue with their mind-body work as well. And in 1993, she opened the La Casa Day Spa in the Fullerton District of New York City, now the oldest spa in New York. And let us say, Jane, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Did I say that right? Is it hormesis effect?
It is. That's exactly how you say it.
This is a good way to start.
Should I define it?
Please.
Well, dose is everything. You can, in cancer treatments, the traditional cancer treatment that involves radiation is a very high dose. High dose destroys tissue. It destroys cancer cells, but it also destroys normal cells. And that's the problem with high dose radiation. Low dose radiation has the opposite effect. So anything that you do in dose. You do water in dose. You do food in dose. If you eat too little, you get sick. If you eat too much, you get sick. But if you eat just a little enough that you stress the body or the mind of any substance, then the body goes into survival mode, it goes into repair mode, it goes into stress mode. And in experiencing stress, it rebuilds itself. And that's how radiation hormesis works. That's how intermittent fasting works. That's how exposing yourself. There's a center in New York on 57th Street that it's called CryoLife. I go into a chamber, it is 260 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. My whole body is in it except for my head. My head pops out, and I stay in it for 3 minutes. It's very stressful for the body. It's very cold, and yet it reduces inflammation. It builds tissue. It builds bone strength. It does all kinds of good things to your body because your body basically needs to repair from this stress. So this is good stress, not bad stress.
Now, from what I understand, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, but we all have cancer cells within us. You're born with cancer cells. The problem with the immune system, it fights off antibodies. It fights off anything that gets into that body. But the cancer cells are natural. They're normal. So if it's not foreign to the body, the immune system doesn't pick it up, doesn't catch it until it's too late and it begins to manifest. That's where the problems start. So what I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm... Go ahead.
Yeah, you're correct. That actually is Lewis Thomas's theory of cancer, and he was the president of Sloan Kettering, which, of course, is the bastion of traditional medical practice and thought. So, yes, we do all have cancer cells circulating within us. There was a study done some years ago. They just did random autopsies of people. They found that 30% of the people had had cancer, unbeknownst to them, undiagnosed, and completely unrelated to the cause of death. So the problem is that the immune system in cancer conditions is sleeping on the job. It's not recognizing that this entity is going to cause our destruction and our death. So it just kind of... all of the defensive systems that we have available to us in the human body aren't activated. So you're not mounting a response to deactivate the cancer cells.
Okay, so we're dealing with stress with two completely different definitions. One is that anti-health definition, where basically it causes problems in your life. The other one is to create stress intentionally. That's what I want. To intentionally create the stress. Yeah. To intentionally create it to be able to take care of what's needed. Now, are you familiar, and she's passed away a long time ago, with Virginia Livingston?
Yes, of course. She cured a lot of people of cancer.
Absolutely, she did. And, and no chemotherapy, no radiation based on
But you know what? Michael, there are so many people that are doing that. There are 1,000 cures for cancer. You know, you can cure cancer with herbs. You can cure cancer with detox. You can cure cancer by changing your diet. I've worked with so many cancer patients that have been given terminal diagnoses, and 30 years later, they're alive and kicking and, you know, doing what it is that they were meant to do. Let me just say something about stress. Hans Selye was the scientist that first used the term and then identified what happens on a physiological level under stress. He put rats and mice on a rooftop in frigid Canada, and he starved them, and he made them cold, and he made them exercise, and then he dissected them, and he wanted to find what was the one thing that we could define as stress. But in doing this research, he did discover exactly what you've just said, that there's good stress and there's bad stress, and he called the good stress eustress, E-U stress. So, yes, the deliberate application of stress is the key to staying healthy and living longer. We're stressing our bodies all the time. So the only question is whether or not you're overstressing to the point where you're not going to recover. The whole point is resiliency, recoverability, regeneration. I call it bounceability. Your body has to be able to bounce back from the stress.
Okay, so we're really dealing with chemical reactions in the body when you get into, you know, the survival mode, quote-unquote, and we're dealing also with energy. Energy in and of itself I really believe is the key to all of it. If that energy is blocked and it doesn't go to those certain parts in the body to make it work, you're going to have problems. So it's opening up those pathways so the energy can go to where it's supposed to go and do the healing.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct about energy. The energy has to be free-flowing throughout the body. And wherever you have, for instance, I was just at my spa wellness center, and there's a woman that had implants in her breast. She has been so seriously ill, her brain can't function. She's clearly a very smart woman. So the implants have leaked out the silicon, and the silicon is now in her lymph glands next to her breast. Her breast, that whole area is completely swollen. She had saline coated with silicon. Saline as implants is banned in every country except the United States. So so she just had a complete thorough blood test, and she found out that she's off the chart in terms of heavy metal toxicity. It's from the silicon. It's from the saline. The saline is creating fungal and mold growth inside her body. So she needs to detoxify. She needs serious detoxification.
Now, let's talk. We've heard this word radioactive thrown around, you know, so many times with so many different variables and definition. But what are we dealing with when we're dealing with how you use the radioactive hormesis?
Well, let me say first that life can't exist without radioactivity, that life was created out of radioactive energy. So it's here, it's ubiquitous. Our bodies need it. But the question is, in what dose do our bodies need it? The dose, as I said, for cancer treatments is too high of a dose because it destroys normal tissue, and then that just makes your battle against the cancer even harder. So with hormesis, you're using a very low dose. So we're using stones, and we have gauss meters and the people that mine the stones. Every stone that they take out and they cut up and sell has been gone through the gauss meter, so they know exactly what the dosage is that they're giving people. So I want to just cite two studies that are really interesting. One of them was done by a guy named Bernie Cohen, who was in I think it was at the University of Pittsburgh. He was living in Pennsylvania, and he was living near the Reading Prong, which is a place where wherever there's kind of a fission in earth, that's a good place for radioactivity to seep up from underneath the surface of the earth. You see that in hot springs. Every time you have a hot spring, I mean, hot springs are really healing. Everybody that's ever been to one knows that. They feel the effect. It's because it's radioactive. It's coming up from the bowels of the earth, bringing the radioactivity up with it. So the Reading Prong happens to be a very high radon area. Of course, radon is a gas, so the gas is seeping up through the crack in the earth. So, but I guess because he lived there, he was interested specifically in radon. So Bernie Cohen did the largest epidemiological study that has ever been conducted in the U.S. He essentially took a map of 90% of the counties of the U.S. He took a map of radon measurement and then overlaid on that a map of cancer statistics. He fully expected to see high radon, high cancer. He was very surprised when he saw the opposite. He saw high radon, low cancer. He didn't believe it. He sliced up the data in all kinds of ways that you can try to control variables, you know, smoking and eating and age and blah, blah, blah. And 5 years later, it showed the same effect no matter how he sliced up the data. So he still didn't believe it. So he repeated the study. He did it all over again. And when he got the same result, he went down into his basement and he turned off the radon eliminator. So the point is that in New Jersey, which is where I own a house, it's by law, it was passed, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago when they started thinking that radon was causing cancer. By law, when you sell your house, you have to have a radon test. And if you have radon in the basement, then you have to get a radon eliminator. So this multi-million dollar business was created on the idea that you're going to get cancer if you have high radon. If I have high radon in my basement, I should be opening a spa there. I should be inviting the whole neighborhood to come in.
Okay, with the exception of dosage. Didn't you say that there was a certain amount of dosage?
But any of the radon that you're getting that's you know, coming from that far away from the bowels of the earth, That was the study that he did. That radon promotes longer life and better health.
Okay, where is that? Let me ask you this. Where is the challenge? You know, the AMA, American Medical Association, there's conventional medicine. Now, doctors are starting to look now at different ways to do things, different healing processes, et cetera. But where's the biggest challenge? Is it in the pharmaceutical industry, you know, where the money's being made and coming from, that stops people like you? Because I'm totally behind you. I'm 3,000%, let me say it up front. But where is the stop? What causes you not to be in every hospital and every doctor's office?
Well, I heard that there were two industries that were growing in the United States, and one of them is prison and one of them is pharmaceutical.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that that statistic is correct. The pharmaceutical industry, you know, has just pretty much taken over the world.
Yeah, absolutely, no question.
And that's where it is.
But somebody
comes to me and they have a recent cancer diagnosis and they tell me they're going to a second opinion and they go to another physician and it's not a second opinion. They've all been trained in the same way and they all think the same way. A true second opinion is somebody, you know, who trained in Tibetan medicine. That's a second opinion.
Yeah, remember I had mentioned Virginia Livingston earlier. 18, 19 years ago, I personally got diagnosed with stage 3B lung cancer.
Oh,
so they took out.
That's interesting.
Oh yeah, I took out my right lung, part of the lining of my heart, and there was residual cancer left on my heart. And they said that with chemotherapy and radiation, they gave me about a year and a half to live. That was almost 20 years ago. I've had no chemo, no radiation. Somehow I got directed down to San Diego, and that's where I came through. But I'm fine.
Oh, so you worked with Virginia Livingston.
Well, not her personally. She'd already passed away when I got there.
But with her system?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Now, they're closed down. I think the AMA shut them down years ago. But, yeah, I went through that system, you bet.
Yeah. Well, like I said, there are a lot of ways to skin this cancer cat, and she certainly did a good job. You know, there are people all over the world that really have good answers for how to reverse cancer.
Well, absolutely. No question about it. But the point of contention is that you're there, you're doing it, and you're out there in the public letting them know. That's the important thing. Because when you really come down to it, most people have no concept, no idea. You walk into the doctor's office, the doctor says you're going to die. Well, let me go write my will, I'm gone. You know, the doctor's the be-all, end-all, almighty. And not that their egos are like that, but we have been trained when the doctor says it, that's the end of it. You do what the doctor says.
Right.
Now, recently, we're getting second opinions, and we're also having, you know, people come in with us to make sure that we hear what we hear, you know. But there's so much of this that the basic population is uninformed with.
One of my patients came in, my psychoanalytic patients came in a couple of weeks ago and said that her husband was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And that he had had a biopsy, he landed in the hospital with a massive infection and almost died. And I said to her, do you read my holistic newsletter? I do a holistic newsletter called Musings from 20th Street because my wellness center is on 20th Street in Manhattan. And about a year ago, I did a whole report on cancer stats, cancer diagnoses, and I talked specifically about the biopsies that they do for prostate cancer. And the rate is very high for people that end up in the hospital with massive infections. So the next day, right after she gave me that news, I got an email from a relative who said, this is so sad. This relative of ours, you know, it was the woman's husband she was writing about. He had a biopsy for prostate, and 24 hours later, he's dead. He got sepsis. That happens with prostate biopsies. So I feel like I'm a lone wolf screaming in the wilderness because I do have all this information. I have 8,000 people that subscribe to my newsletter. You know, it's nothing to sneeze at. It's not great, but it's not bad. But I don't even, you know, maybe only 20 of them are reading it. The information is out there. Anybody that wants the information, they can get the information. They just have to be interested, and they have to give up the medical model because the medical model is going to lead you into the hospital.
Jane, can we add something to this? Okay, that you speak a language, you know, and every profession has their own language. And it's a language that the majority of people have no idea of that language. And 9 out of 10 times, and I say you, me, all of us, it's not you, okay, in the general sense of the word. You speak a language that you're there with, you know, 8, 10, 15, 20 hours a day, and the people that you're addressing don't hear you. They hear the words, but they don't really hear what it is that's going on. And I think that's the major problem when something is good out there for the public. 80-some-odd percent of that public gets left because they didn't hear it in the way they've learned to bring it in, take it in. And when you're dealing with a different language, quote-unquote, you're dealing with 12, 13-year-olds. You know, if you put me behind your desk, I'm going to get lost. So you've got to bring it down to a way that, you know, we can relate and we're both on the same page. But that's really what it is. Most people would love to have what you've got. They're scared. They're running around. They're frightened to death. If they know there's somebody out there that will hold them by the hand, take them through and fix it, all of a sudden there's this strength, there's this power that they get within themselves. But it has to be done in such a way that it's not what you say, it's what they hear. And they hear it in the way that you meant it.
Yeah, you're right. I want to mention, there are two people that have done videos specifically on cancer. One of them is Britton Goldberg, who's now, he may be 89. Last time I saw him a few months ago, he was 88. Still going strong. He did a DVD. His website is BrittonGoldberg.com. And you can order the DVD. He went to Mexico. He went to Europe. In Europe, they're doing targeted chemo. If you do targeted chemo, if it's really targeted the way they're doing in Germany and Switzerland, you get no side effects from it. So that's not done anywhere in the United States. So he interviewed all the physicians that are doing that. For instance, ozone. We have ozone at my center here. And ozone kills every pathogen known to mankind. 70 to 80% of the MDs in Germany use ozone. They don't have to do amputations. I have a friend that I have an energy scanning system. It reads the energy of the bodies, and it can tell you what's wrong. It can tell you what's about to go wrong, that kind of thing. I scanned the brother of a friend of mine, and it came up gangrene. So I said, are you diabetic? He said, yes. I said, are you having a problem with one of your legs? He said, yes. So here we are a month later. He had his toe removed. It was gangrenous. They don't have to do that in Germany. They just throw in some ozone, which is just activated oxygen. It's O3. And it brings blood circulation back to the veins. So in this case, Germany's way far ahead of us with ozone. Yep. It's hardly used in the United States at all.
But are you using it in your center?
We don't do IV ozone. There are some physicians that do it that way. We do steam cabinet, which I love because it goes into the pores of all your body. The other DVD series that I want to mention is Ty Bollinger. He did a series, I think, of 11 videos, and again, he interviewed people that are doing holistic and alternative therapy specifically for cancer. That's called The Truth About Cancer. So those are really great resources for people to get information from.
Absolutely.
The other study
very close to being out of time, but go ahead.
I just wanted to mention Nagasaki Hiroshima in terms of radiation hormesis. So
yes.
The people that were killed immediately, they were killed because they were burned to death because it was really hot. But then the Japanese know so much about radiation because they were exposed to this. They've been studying it ever since. So if you just draw out concentric circles from the zero point where the bombs hit, and then you study the cancer stats from that, the people that are the farthest out that had no exposure to radiation have lived shorter lives than the people that were farther in and had some exposure, or what I'm calling low-dose exposure, to the radiation. There are over 3,000 studies that have been done all over the world in terms of radiation hormesis, low-level radiation, where they know that you have more fertility, you have longer life, you have better health, you have everything good that you want out of life.
Wonderful. Okay, we're about out of time. And a website we can find you at, and the book, and the books, and how to get to the center.
It's La Casa Spa and Wellness Center. LaCasaSpa.com is the website. My personal website is drjanegoldberg.com. I've written 7 books. They're all available on Amazon. Hormesis Effect is available from Amazon and also from the publisher, Sea Raven Press. So I encourage people to, most of my writing, it's either on holistic health or psychoanalysis, because I kind of wear both hats at various times, but then it becomes one big hat that merges the two because, of course, the body and the mind are not separated.
That's so true. Now, by the way, if anybody missed any of this, your website's up on our website right now. And I want to thank you so much for what you do and also being here today.
Michael, it's such a pleasure to meet you this way. I had no idea you were a cancer cure person. You've been cured of cancer.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't talk about it a lot, but every once in a while it comes up and it's appropriate at the right time.
Absolutely. People need to know there are ways out there that don't poison you.
Yeah, and if you ask Radio Susie, I'm still ornery.
Well, that's good.
Doing,
you need that.
Okay. All right. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Michael. Bye.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the right Michael, whatever my name is, Michael Dresser Show. Brian McAllister with us, the author of Full Recovery, The Recovering Person's Guide to Unleashing Your Inner Power. Brian was born into a working-class Irish Catholic family in a small town in New Jersey, not far from Manhattan. And as a young man, he descended into alcoholism and drug abuse, and for most of his 20s led the life of a nomadic drug-addicted biker. A horrific motorcycle accident started Brian on the road to recover, the realization that he had a higher purpose. It also saved his marriage and his relationship with his son. And after getting sober in 1990, he became a successful businessman, an entrepreneur, counselor, and motivational speaker in the recovery community. Brian was named a board member at the Freedom House, one of the country's leading addiction treatment centers, where he worked with hundreds of clients and honed what would become his Full Recovery philosophy and program. He published his first edition of Full Recovery in 2008 and soon after opened the Full Recovery Wellness Center in Fairfield, New Jersey. Brian, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Brian, when it really comes down to it, there it seems as though that somebody has to hit the bottom before they realize that they can move upward and forward. And I think what I'm getting out of this, what I like about what you're doing, you're catching them before they hit bottom.
That's true, Michael. And what's interesting is everybody gets to choose their own bottom. My bottom was particularly low, but some people, just a DUI or being out of control of their faculties or wrecking a relationship. So hopefully they can step off the elevator before they hit the basement like I did. So it's an interesting thing, but pain is really the best friend of change when it comes to the addiction game.
Oh, absolutely. Now, by the way, with the motorcycle accident, where was it? When did that light bulb go on to say, this is it, this is enough, I'm done?
Well, it actually happened 6 full years before I got sober because, again, everybody's bottom is different. I was in Phoenix, Arizona, about 40 miles outside of Phoenix when I wiped out my bike, broke my back, was going to have my leg amputated, just a whole horrific scene. But like most alcoholics and addicts, you know, we talk to ourselves and we convince, hey, I convinced myself that killing myself was a party. I can convince myself of just about anything. But that accident, not only did it made me call out to God first time. I thought I was an atheist.
Yeah.
When you're in the emergency room and they say they're going to amputate your leg, it's amazing how you can throw that right out the window and start asking God for help.
Oh, yeah.
And I asked God for help.
I'm laughing, but that's so true.
extent. It is. It's amazing. No atheist in a foxhole, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. No question about it. When it really comes down to it, the key, you sound like are you military?
No. I'm not military, but you know, it's just a good analogy that when things are at their worst and your ego goes aside and you have nothing else to hang on to. That's what happened with me. And 6 years later, I continued. After I got out of bed and I learned how to walk after a couple of years, mm-hmm. you know, when I finally got to my bottom 6 years later, I remembered that moment in the hospital when I called out to my maker and asked him for help. And I called out again, and that's when I got treatment that day.
You know, when it comes down to it, you know, Brian, you can look back at your life and everything that ever happened to you. You can say thank you. You know, send him a gift, because if it wasn't for everything that happened, the motorcycle accident, you know, the alcoholism and whatever, you wouldn't be here now doing what you do.
Absolutely. All that hard living now is being put to good use, and every adversity is turned into an opportunity. That's the way this thing works.
Now, when people come to you, is there a commonality of definition of why they come? Do they talk about that certain something missing in their life?
You know, lack of self-esteem, not feeling that they fit in, is probably the most common trait among all the people that I see. And that's why they start self-medicating. It makes them feel good. It makes them feel comfortable in their own skin. But, of course, it only works temporarily, because when it turns into addiction, now you have all the new challenges and problems that go with an addictive lifestyle. So that's probably the most common trait. And, you know, there's a lot. The reason it's a disease is because everybody has the same symptoms, and most people had them before they started. For example, alcoholics and addicts have an intense single-minded focus. Think about what extremes they'll go to get what they want. They are very committed. They are risk-averse, because think about it. They will risk their health, their family, their job, all these other things. So there's a lot very creative what they'll do to get what they want. These things I didn't understand when I was young and drinking and drugging, but they're really gifts. Because when I figured out how to get sober and then take my God-given gifts and point them towards my dreams and my goals, they turned into just an outstanding way of life for me, because it helped me in business, helped me become an entrepreneur. All these things that I was using to drive myself into the gutter were really the same skill set I used to push myself up the mountain. And now I show other people how to do the same thing.
Yeah, now, Brian, stop me if I'm wrong. Let me tell you what I just heard, okay? That the common reason people come to you is they have no identity. And what you're really doing is help them become who they are, which is an identity. And anybody who's been addictive, they don't have an identity, and they don't feel good about it, so they bury it, you know, whether it's drugs, alcohol, whatever the case may be. And then when you find that certain something that you've been looking for has been within you all the time, and then you open the door and you let it out, all of a sudden the world looks completely different. Same things happen, but the approach is different.
That's absolutely the truth. What happens is we don't have to manufacture anything with these folks. Number one is we have to meet them where they're at. We have to inspire them. We show them that we've experienced the same challenges that they have. And then we go beyond abstinence and just simply not drinking and drugging. You've got to substitute something for that. So we draw out their dreams. We draw out their desires. We show them how to overcome their fears and all the things that have been holding them back. And when you do that, you see the light go on. And that's the missing part of most treatment programs, is they don't understand that part of it. And I'm blessed to be surrounded with a group of people who work with me who are absolutely not just the best in the business on the cutting edge of the clinical end of treatment, but they've all managed to overcome incredible odds in their lives. And what we do is we show other folks that they can too.
Okay, then, and there's that realization. Now, how do you bring them to that? But when I say that, you know, it's like anything else. You know, when you're in the middle of it and you're going through all the misery and somebody's up there saying, oh, you can be happy. Yeah, right, sure. Okay, how do you get them on that first step to be able to realize that the possibility is there?
Well, there's definitely a clinical part. You have to detox. You have to, and depression and guilt and remorse and shame go with that. It's part of it. So it's got to be the carrot and the stick. You've got to show them the carrot. And not just myself have become successful, but the folks that I'm surrounded with have overcome everything from cancer to being a crack addict, from broken families, from PTSD to all different types of issues. So if we have the right coach for the right person that can connect with somebody on a human level. You know, you can't be judgmental. These people are beaten down. They're hopeless. They're broken people. And what we do is we know how to build them back up and turn their dreams into reality, how to draw out those lost desires that we all have. There's a purpose for everyone.
Sure.
We give them permission to be the person God created them to be.
You know, a very interesting point also, I have your book in my hand, and I'm looking at the back of it, and this, I think, is critical to recovery. And it top says, so you're in recovery, you know, what's next? But that's the whole key. Where do you go from there? I think that's, you know, you can detox, you can clean up, but it's that decision of who I want to be and where I want to go that I think is the real essence of whether they're going to make it or not.
That's true. And alcoholics and addicts are just by nature more people. Too much of everything isn't enough. That's the way they're made. They're people that keep pushing the envelope, that always want to do a little more, that always want to see what's around the next corner. And sometimes, especially in a rigid educational structure or in certain family structures, those qualities aren't really nurtured. People are really told, like, you know, right now, think about what we do with people who are type A personality children. You know, it's very popular to give them Ritalin and other drugs. You know, but really, these are the next group of entrepreneurs, the next group of non-cook who really make things happen in this world. And you know, what we do is, again, we let people be themselves. We show them how to draw this out. I'll tell you a quick story. We had a guy we picked up from the psych ward. Real quickly, he was arrested, put in the psych ward. We took him into our facility. He wound up, you know, I was asking him, you seem really bright. You're reading books like you're going crazy. The guy's got a master's degree from the London School of Economics. So I said, like, how did you get involved in that? And why is it, as we started going through the process of the full recovery program, drawing out what he's into, he doesn't like economics. He hated it. His family forced him into that. He wasn't being true to himself. He liked working with his hands. He liked doing things different. So what we did was we figured out what he wanted to do. He wanted to become an environmentalist. He's had a well drilling company in Morocco. Now he owns an electronics business over there, and he's making tons of money. He's sober now for 4 years. He's happy. It was like Shakespeare said, to thine own self be true. He's living his truth. And that's what people got to understand. We give them permission to live their truth.
Absolutely. Found his identity. You know, and it's very interesting. I think there's a transition. Yeah, interesting word. Gave him permission to be. That's what they're looking for. When I say they, so many people out there, they're waiting for somebody else to tell them. Once they get told, they can do it. And then they begin to realize that the person that they need to get permission from is themselves. But in that very first part, they need somebody that they can model after that says, you know, you can do this.
Exactly. And you see, addiction is a generational disease. You know, people get passed down more than hair color in their eyes. They've actually, you know, isolated the addiction gene. And it's part, you know, DNA, but it's also more than that. It's environment. It's the way you were grown up. Like, I grew up in a family where alcoholism was never spoken of. It was just a rite of passage. People drank. You know, people did this. And you know, I knew things weren't right, but I never knew there was another way. When I finally got sober, I was blessed that somebody took me under their wing and they showed me how to be a man. I had to change my idea of what manhood was. It wasn't how much money I had, how many cars I had, how many women I had. It was getting up and doing the right thing on a daily basis when nobody was looking. It was bringing the paycheck home to my wife and my son. It was doing the right thing for the right reason. So these are things that once you show people the benefits of living this way, because once I combine that lifestyle with my natural abilities, like I said, to handle risk, to read people, to be creative, to be committed to a project like I was when I was committed to getting alcohol and drugs, there was no stopping me when you combine the two of them. And that's what we show, and it works. It works. Nobody really wants to be an alcoholic or an addict. It's a crummy life.
No, and then they learn what the real definition of the R word is, which is responsibility. You know, years ago, I remember I was, 16, 17 years old. I'm sitting in the car, and my girlfriend's breaking up with me. She met an older man. He was just beginning in college. And I remember what she said to me. She said, he's more of a man than you'll ever be. Okay, now, at 16 or 17, the first thought in my head was, yeah, I can kick his butt right at the man. As I grew, I began to realize that the definition of a man is someone who takes responsibility for his actions. And I think that's probably the best thing she could have ever said to me. It would have never triggered me into that definition.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what we do. And we're such a diverse group. When I wrote my first book, you know, I was working, I was on the board of Freedom House, and I was developing this philosophy because I saw so many people relapse, and I was able to stay sober. I've just celebrated 25 years clean and sober. You don't see a lot of people like that. And I started asking myself better questions. Why is that? And it's because people don't go with the whole, people think of holistic as just, you know, exercise or eating or things. It's your career. It's your finances. It's learning to have quality relationships, the way you treat yourself, self-respect. So that's what we give to these folks, and we mentor them. And they're not just with us for 15 minutes. Once you go through our program, you're with us for life. You're welcome back forever. And we expect people to come back and
give
the next
guy. You've got to have that support system.
Yep,
you've got to have that support system. Yeah. And it doesn't matter what it is. We're human beings. We need to know that there are people there. And the most important thing is that we're not alone. You know, you can have a problem and you can be around tons of people, but if you've got nobody there to understand what it is that you're going through, you're very much alone.
And that's addiction is a disease of isolation. It's fear and isolation.
Yep.
And those two things have to be overcome to get you to move forward. You know, I had to ask somebody, how do you do this? I had to ask somebody, can the same process by opening myself up and humbling myself, saying I don't know something, help me get sober? Will the same thing work in my finances? Will it work in my marriage? Will it work in my career? And the answer was yes. And it was so simple, I almost missed it.
Yeah. You know, and it's an interesting point. We become addicted because we don't feel anybody's going to accept us, so we get addicted for acceptance. But then the thing to get out of addiction is acceptance. You know, it takes you in and it takes you out. It wears a different face.
It really does. It's very perceptive, but there's a lot of truth in that. And as far as the isolation part, it becomes so lonely, and you feel so down on yourself that right now, prisons are becoming our treatment facilities. You know, we have, you know, and yet I volunteer in the prisons, and 90% of the folks that I see in prison, and this is a national statistic, have an alcohol and drug problem. And I tell them the same thing. If you can get past that, if you can figure out how to come in here and not drink and drug one day at a time, there's a 90% chance you'll never go back to jail again. It's that simple. And the thing
no
is,
question
because
about
they're. They're felons, so they can't get a job even at, you know, at a fast food restaurant with a felony. So what we do is we show them how to be entrepreneurs. We show them how to go out there and make a living for their family. And my book is full of all those types of stories, people we've worked with that have come from some really horrific situations and now are highly successful and respected members of their community.
No, which is great. Now, we're just about out of time, so let me ask you this. Website we can find you at?
www.fullrecoverywellnesscenter.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, if anybody missed it, it's up on our website. Now, I'm going to tell you something, but you got to promise not to tell anybody, okay? Promise?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. I still think I can kick his butt.
Well, that's half the battle right there, right?
I got it. Hey, Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, too, Michael, for having me on. God bless you.
Oh, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Chinese.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Lynette Vincent with us, the co-author of Ravage Me, How to Indulge in Your Desires and Avoid the Lunacies of Love, Sex, and Relationships. She's a native of Seattle, Washington, and an Atlanta transplant, always with a nose in at least 13 books during any given summer vacation. She craves her eclectic storyline dynamics and began penning her own stories at the age of 12 just for fun. And she lives for the weekend and doesn't mind paying it forward. Lynette, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you so much for being here. You know, if you look at the tagline, you know, your desires and avoid the or how to indulge in your desires and avoid the lunacies of love, sex, and relationships. You know, each one of those things have a different set of dynamics, a set of definitions, a set of language and communication, and it seems as though what we think people like, we do, and we forget ourselves, and the next thing you know, you go through all these things and you're still left empty.
I agree. We often put what we desire on hold and we settle, and then we have train wrecks after we settle.
Oh, absolutely, no question about it. What was it that caused you to look at this particular subject matter the way you did and then put it to pen?
Well, it all began with I was having a rough time with disappointment in relationship, and I wasn't able to process in a healthy manner. So I started looking to love addiction classes. I was just wondering, what's going on with me? What's my problem? And one day I just sat down at the computer and I just started outlining, and it started making sense.
Now, what did you find? What did you find that you didn't know about you?
I found that I often put a muzzle on myself. I wasn't open, and that it's okay to be brazen. You know, even if someone that you love or that you're infatuated with would walk away, because it's better to be a healthier you than to appease someone else.
Oh, absolutely. Let me give you a great example of that. You ready for this? I've probably done this example 50,000 times now if I've done it once, but it really brings the point home. Go ahead, ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead, ask me.
Are you good looking?
Funny you should ask that. You know, and absolutely, and if you don't think so, somebody else will. See, the key here is this. If I have the ability to take five women and get behind each one individually and look at me through their eyes, I see a gorgeous Michael, a homely Michael, an okay Michael, or whatever. And you can't please everybody, so just go with the ones who think you're gorgeous, which means to do exactly what you just said. Just let it out and be who you are. If they can't deal with it, go away, because otherwise you're going to stuff yourself for the rest of your life.
Absolutely. You'll be miserable, and then it'll pop
Absolutely.
Up in every relationship.
No, no question. So I really think that's the key. So expressing, okay, that's really when it comes down to it. What's that first step in the ability to express that person you're with?
That first step is you tell them what you want. You have a heart-to-heart. And, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be formal. You know, you're just open. And what you have to say, you know, be willing to brace yourself and deal with it, whether it's going to be, you know, a heartache or, you know, or a coming together. You have to be willing to face that music.
Linda, you know what's interesting? And I've seen this over the years. Most people don't know what they want. So if you don't know what you want, quote unquote, rhetorically, how are you going to get it? So realistically, is there a method to find out what you want?
Experimentation. I actually talk about that in one of my chapters. Taste versus desire. And taste is if you buy the Albertsons or your local grocery store, you know, brand bread because it's cheap and it fits your budget. But you really desire, you know, Sara Lee or, you know, some other well-known name brand. But you suppress that desire because of what's cheap, what fits in the meantime.
Okay, so basically what you're doing is you're giving up. You're just letting yourself go, and you're taking what's there just to get by.
Yeah, just to get by, and that has to do with relationships. I say, you know, you'll get this person because they fit, and you fit into their world. You're a blue-class worker. They're a blue-class worker. You know, it's ideal. Your families grew up together, and, oh, you know, that's the best that you could get, and that's all that you settle for, but that's not what you want.
I guess sitting down and writing it all out and identifying unhealthy codependent behavior, et cetera, and I want to go back to basically if you don't know, you can't find out. It's got to be pointed out. You have to look at it third party from the outside in to really see it.
Yes, yes. When you're codependent, you're like, oh, I can't live without him or I can't live without her or, you know, you start being, instead of being affectionate, you become possessive and obsessive, then you really need to take a look at yourself and say, okay, I'm too codependent on this person for everyday life.
And you know what I think it comes down to? The difference between want and need. 2002, I had gotten divorced, and I was at the house. I stayed there. And, you know, we were together for a lot of years, and so her ghost was running around the house constantly. And I remember one night I started to make dinner. I was making tacos. And the dogs and the cats were there. And I started making tacos. And I filled the kitchen table up. I mean, we were talking. We could have fed 12, 13 people at the time. I was just there by myself. And I sat down and I started to really enjoy the meal. And it hit me. I didn't need anybody there to enjoy myself. Didn't mean I didn't want someone there. But I didn't need anybody. I could go to a restaurant if I wanted to by myself and enjoy it, didn't need anybody to come with me. And I think that's a major bridge to cross when people begin to realize the difference between want and need.
Yeah, when you're confident within yourself, like you yourself sat there at the table and say, I don't have this itching feeling to have to be surrounded by people to just enjoy this taco fest that I'm having at the table.
Yeah.
I can eat all these tacos by myself. You know, and
they did taste good.
Yeah. I love tacos, by the way.
Yeah, good. Now, by the way, avoiding romantic sex traps, that is a key. You get all frustrated or all turned on and excited at the moment, and nothing else matters.
Yeah, when you know, you're out there, you're on the hunt, you know, whether you're single or you're married and you're dating and you're looking and you're like, caught up, and I said, well, people, when they get involved sexually, they're dizzy and they're drunk, you know, I'm off the high of just being with that person, that rapid intimacy, you know, there's no bond there to see, okay, where can we go further from here outside of the sex?
Yeah, and that's really a key. I like the way you said when you're on the hunt. I'm going to write that down. Okay. And then, and leading it up to this, which I think is true, you know, finding your voice in relationships, it's so hard for so many people. If I tell you what I think, you're not going to like me anymore. Yeah.
You have to be willing to let them walk away because do you want to be miserable with migraines or sick because you just stayed frozen? No.
Well, absolutely. You know, there's so many people who stuff it because they're afraid to open their mouth. You know, if I'm not what I think you want me to be, you're going to walk away. And that's a problem. And you get stuck with that for 10 or 20 years, and all of a sudden when you realize it, there's a lot of your life that you let go by.
That was me. I, when I had that startling realization of, no, I don't like this. I started telling everyone what I don't like, you know, from mom to sister, dad, brother, husband, you know, I let it all out.
Yeah. But it's such a good thing, and if they can't deal with it, you're not with the right person.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's
yeah.
a maturity thing, you know, being able to take what I say. People say, I want the truth 100%, but not everyone's ready to handle the truth 100%. But
no.
This is my truth, and you can choose to embrace it, you know, or you can
yeah.
go on your way.
Yeah. You know, and it's so hard for so many people. You know, I've said this for years and years and years and years, what I truly believe is when you're in school, they should have classes on romance, classes on relationships, classes on marriage, but they don't do that. You know, you go into a marriage or a relationship, and you're supposed to know all the ins and outs. Well, that's not so.
Not at all. Not at all. It's
yeah.
like I said, you in one of my chapters, in that same chapter, Taste Versus Desire, you build how you learn things with your palate. You build flavor combinations that you like, and you learn to figure out, okay, well, this tastes similar to a banana or a mango. You know, it's a taste test.
Yeah. Well, absolutely it is. You know, and when it really comes down, because look at the amount of divorces that we have and the high percentage of divorces in the first year.
Yeah, divorces are rampant. People, they've either A, grown apart, or B, it was rapid, you know, romance from the beginning, and they didn't have a true, deep, shared connection to stay together, you know. So the incompatibility within the relationship itself.
Well, sure. You look at the amount of single women, single moms, not single women, single moms out there today. They don't need to be married.
And some of them don't feel that, you know, if you set yourself aside. If that's your goal, that you want to be married, okay, sure, I applaud you. You know, but if you feel that you are being, you know, disenfranchised by being with multiple men or multiple women, and you have a sad, lonely life, you only have yourself to blame. You know, because you chose
sure.
to not, yeah, you chose to not say anything and say, you know what, I don't like this. I'm going to present myself with the image of the woman that I am and the woman or the man that I want to be with.
Oh, yeah, and by the way, there is a tremendous amount of shame that goes with relationships, and people just don't know how to get over that. How do you deal with that? How do you remove it?
The shame is, this is who I am, you know. You have to be unapologetic to a degree. I mean, there are things that are going to cause offense, but if we lived our life on eggshells, we wouldn't be happy people, you know. We just be repressed, and then that repression, it's almost like, you know, you go to get a bag of potato chips. You eat just a little, and that was your intention. Oh, I just wanted to snack on it. And before you know it, you're eating the whole bag because you tried to repress the fact that that's what you really wanted. You wanted to eat the whole bag, but you try to repress
yeah.
yourself to just a few chips.
But that's the whole point. How many people do you know in your life, friends, etc., that have that kind of freedom, and have created that kind of freedom? Probably very few.
Very few that express that. They're online and they're dating. They're being introduced to men and women through other networks, or they've been divorced multiple times, you know, or they're just saying, well, I'm happy with, you know, my mate, and, you know, we don't have to be married, but we have a great relationship, you know. So that's what
yeah.
appears to work for them.
It's also called telling the truth, and that's a very hard thing for a lot of people to do. I know people that are on these dating websites should hear some of the stories that come back.
Yeah, they're just afraid for the feedback, you know, what's coming on the other side. Like I talked about in another chapter about being love-starved, that when you're love-starved, you're easy prey to be manipulated and discarded like flavorless gum. And there was a dramatization about a blogger. She met a guy online, and she just broke up with the first love of her life, and she was extremely vulnerable, and she ended up being, you know, lured to an undisclosed location, whereas that she
mm-hmm.
got raped, but she wanted
yeah.
the applause on the opposite side of the camera, the webcam.
Yeah.
She wanted applause.
I got, you know, when somebody's love starved, I've got the answer to that. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
Get a dog. Get a puppy.
Or a cat.
Or a cat, absolutely, no question about it. I have three of the little monsters, the cats. But the point is, that's all they want. Why can't people be more like cats and dogs?
Well, cats and dogs, if you get them from a baby, I've had cats most of my life. You get cat from a baby, you let them sleep in the bed with you, and they get used to your smell, and you have their cat hair all over your clothes, and, you know.
Of course. What's life without cat hair? But
what's
you can tell, if you go to the market, you go to the market, and you can tell people when you're in the pet food aisle. The people that are getting the dog food, they're throwing the cans of the dog food into the cart. The cat people are sitting there psychologically going through, will they like this? Will they eat that? They had that last time. And you watch your cat people, they take their time before they buy anything because they don't want to offend the cat.
Yeah, cats are some picky creatures, especially those tabby cats. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, they know what they want. But they're great lessons. You know, dogs and cats are great lessons. They're completely different. There's no question about it. But they're life lessons if we take the time and we actually look at it. Now, I pick the book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael, get that I did not have before I read this book?
What Michael will have when he walks away from reading the book, he's going to look at it himself and assess where he came from in relationships or where he would like to go, you know, expressing that voice that he didn't have or that he could express in a more eloquent way as to who he want, you know, who he wants and what he desires, you know, and stating those facts emphatically because that's your truth.
That's really the key, isn't it? Is it being able to, number one, identify your truth and then learning. It doesn't come naturally. Then learning how to express it.
Yes, they all come through, like with me. My truth was I had a lot of discoveries. It was like, oh, no, I don't like this. No, I don't like that. And then I started expressing, okay, I really don't like that. And then the person would look at me kind of crazy, and I didn't care. And then, you know, all those I didn't cares, you know, just went on after time, and it didn't faze me. I went on unfazed.
Yeah, you know what I found? That, you know, over the years, I've sat down with either man or woman, doesn't matter. Let's say woman at this point, and say, describe your husband to me, first husband. Or better yet, I take it back. It went like this. Define your mother emotionally to me, not physically, emotionally. And then define your, you know where I'm going. And then define your father emotionally. And then define your husband emotionally. 9 out of 10 times it's going to be one of the two. And we run through life going after the same person, except they've got a different body.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
That's about it, yeah. Ah, that's an old movie. You just told me how old you were. Okay. No, I'm kidding. Okay, we're just about out of time, so let me ask you this. Website we can find you at?
WintersAndMorgan.net.
Wonderful. Okay, and if somebody missed it, it's up on our website, so they can find it there. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Michael Dresser.
I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is
the music story
of
But I